Andrew Alsdorf on behalf of the state. I don't see my counterpart, Mr. Conham.
Neither do I. Let's do this. We'll move to the third matter on the calendar, and I'll ask after that matter whether you're both ready. 4518 South 256 LLC versus Gibbon et al.
Good morning, Your Honors. If I might, could I set up the easel? I have one demonstrative exhibit that was included as an attachment to our briefing that I'd like to refer to.
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Thank you.
My name is Elizabeth Thompson. I am here appearing on behalf of the appellant in this matter, 4518 South 256th LLC. This matter addresses a narrow issue of law. At what point does acceleration occur on an obligation that is secured by a deed of trust?
Let me ask you some questions. As you may know, we discussed this case and all the cases yesterday afternoon. My understanding is this is a residential loan that was taken out in May of 2006, correct?
Yes.
And at that time, the borrowers executed a note and a deed of trust to secure that note, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And the maturity date stated in that note was June 1st, 2036?
I believe that's correct.
Okay. The LLC, your client, acquired title to the property that was subject to the deed of trust in February of 2015.
Yes.
And I take it that you paid the borrowers money and they gave you a deed and that vested title in the LLC, correct?
Yes, the transaction occurred in that manner.
Okay. Now, the essence of your contention is that for a number of reasons, the lender accelerated the maturity of the debt. In other words, called all unpaid amounts due and payable.
Correct.
Okay. In Washington, the law says that that's done by a notice from the lender to the borrower that their lender is exercising the option, right?
Yes.
In this case, I've looked at the notice of default in 2008, and there is no such language in that notice of default. There is a statement that past due payments, expenses, et cetera, are due. But I don't see any exercise by the lender of the option to accelerate the debt. Do you agree?
No, I don't agree.
Why not?
Your Honor. Because it is our contention that in Washington State, you can't invoke the right to a sale without an acceleration occurring, and we cite directly to the statute. This is basically a statute.
I understand that argument that's based on the statute, but my question is, does the notice of default in 2008 give notice to the borrower that the lender was accelerating the maturity of the debt?
We believe it does because it does mention that all of the amounts are going to need to be paid, but it's really not necessary that the notice of default contain the language. It's also the notice of trustee sale.
Okay, I'm getting to that.
Okay.
But my question is, where is the language in the notice of default in 2008 that says a lender is exercising the option to declare the entire unpaid balance due and payable? If you don't know, you can answer on your rebuttal.
I'll take a look at it on rebuttal.
Okay, I have the same question with respect to the notice of trustee sale of 2008. I read it, and I don't see any notice by the lender to the borrower that the unpaid amounts are immediately due and payable. Do you?
Well, the notice of trustee sale contains statutory language, and that statutory language states that before the sale by the borrower, grantor, and guarantor, or the holder of any recorded lien, paying the entire principal and interest secured by the deed of trust, not the amount due or in default, but the entire amount secured by the trust, plus costs and fees, and advances, if any, pursuant to the deed of trust. So we believe that that language, which is actually quoted from RCW 6124040, does provide notice of an acceleration.
Okay.
Because it's not limited to the amount that's allegedly outstanding at that time.
Okay. Now, other than these two documents, is there anything else in the record that came from the lender to the borrower that indicates calling the loan, in other words, declaring all unpaid amounts due and payable?
So if I'm understanding you correctly, are you asking, are there any other documents that were provided that the appellant would consider to be a notice of acceleration?
Yes.
Okay. No.
Okay. So in this record, all that you have is the language or the arguments in your brief and the two documents that we've just talked about.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And our argument in the briefing is based on those documents and in conjunction with the statute.
Okay. Let me turn my attention to one other thing because I want you to have some time. You are asking for attorney's fees on appeal.
That's right.
You, or LLC, did not sign the loan documents, right?
We did not sign the loan documents.
And you did not assume the loan and agree to pay the loan when you got title, correct?
We did not, but the statute includes successors in right to the deed of trust and the property.
Yes, so but my question is, at the time that you obtained title to the property, you did not assume and agree to pay the loan. You understand what I mean?
I do.
Sir.
I understand, okay. And that is correct. We
okay.
did not.
So my question is, not having signed the loan documents, not having assumed the loan, what's the basis for seeking attorney's fees on appeal?
The basis for seeking attorney's fees on appeal is that we should have prevailed at the trial court level, we should have been entitled to attorney's fees.
Yes, but you're relying on the statute that says when there's a contract and mm-hmm. one side is entitled to attorney's fees, if the other side prevails, they're entitled to attorney's fees. But you have to be a party to the contract. So not having signed the loan documents, not having assumed the loan, what basis is there for seeking attorney's fees on appeal?
Well, the damages that we're seeking with regard to the wrongful foreclosure are statutory damages pursuant to 6124 et sequitur. Those damages not only extend to the borrower, they also extend to the successors. And our argument is we are a successor to the borrower in this case. So I hope that answers your question. That's the basis for our request.
Okay.
I just wanted to follow up on one of Judge Cox's questions. So is it appellant's position that the deed of trust statute means that if a foreclosure sale is noticed, that as a matter of law, the underlying obligation is accelerated and payable and due in full?
It is our position that if a sale is noted, and we believe that the statute very clearly ties acceleration and sale, and unlike what the respondents indicate, that those are two elections that are either or. It is our position in reading the statute in conjunction with Washington law, because of the term and, you can't separate the two. And that is underlined by the required language in the deed of trust that is statutory. It has to be in there. So it is our argument that you simply can't have a foreclosure sale without an acceleration of the loan. So I would say yes, Your Honor. That's
and
correct.
Then we've consumed all your time. I apologize for that. None of the notices sent out about the amount owing, though, that were entered in the record show it was the full obligation. It appears to be the arrearages plus interest and penalties. Does that affect your analysis?
I don't think so, because they can put in whatever numbers they want at that point. That doesn't change the statutory language that is required to be in there. And that is the notice to the borrower. And the borrower should be able to rely upon that language. Why? Because that's the language that they sign up to when they borrow. It's in there. And it is our argument that that's part of why a non-judicial foreclosure system works. We can't have acceleration where it requires something entitled notice of acceleration, because our statute says that's not the case. So we believe the language was in there, regardless of the spreadsheets, the amounts that they allege were due or not due, and the fact that if they were to cure before that 11-day period before the sale, they were literally, according to the statute, they were going to have to bring the entire balance due at that time.
Even before the 11th day, they would have to?
Not before, but up to, at
up
that
to.
Point.
Okay.
Unless there are further questions, I'm happy to answer your questions and address those concerns. Do I have any remainder for a rebuttal?
Sure, you have 2 minutes of rebuttal. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Abraham Lorber of Lane Powell for respondents Bank of New York, Mellon, and MERS. Your Honors, obviously the questions raised during the court's questioning of my colleague are relevant to this case, but there's a threshold issue that was not discussed in oral argument but is dealt with in our brief, and that's the issue of mootness and waiver.
Why don't you concentrate your time on the substance? We understand the arguments with respect to those two.
Very good, Your Honor. So I'd like to distinguish, as far as both the language in the deed of trust and the statutory language are concerned, I'd like to distinguish between a borrower's right and a lender's remedy. As the Supreme Court has repeatedly held, there are goals of the Deed of Trust Act, and one of them is to ensure the stability of land titles. In order to ensure the stability of land titles, we want to make sure that non-judicial foreclosures do not occur unless they have to occur. And thus, you have this language in the statute that allows the borrower to cure only the amount due, the amount past due, up to 11 days before the sale. The Myers Way case, which is relied on by both parties, in that case, you had the lender exercise its remedy, which is acceleration. There's no dispute that acceleration was exercised in the Myers Way case. But even though acceleration was exercised, still, if you're going to do a non-judicial foreclosure, the borrower has the right to stop that non-judicial foreclosure sale by only paying the last due amount. That is, the lender's right to accelerate does not accrue in the non-judicial foreclosure context until sooner than 11 days before the sale.
Well, let me ask you this. With respect to the remedies available to a lender, is it the case that acceleration is self-executing? In other words, if a default occurs, does acceleration automatically occur?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, if the lender elects to do a non-judicial foreclosure, is there any necessity to accelerate the maturity of the debt?
No, there is not.
There's an option to accelerate the maturity, but no necessity.
Correct.
All right.
And so, a contrary rule, Your Honor, would actually be prejudicial to borrowers. You could have a case where there's a relatively small amount due. Let's say it's an HOA lien, for example, which are relatively low dollar figures, and a non-judicial foreclosure is optioned. Well, what you really want in that circumstance to further the legislative goals of the Deed of Trust Act is to get the borrower to pay the past amount due. You don't want to have an automatic acceleration option that puts a borrower who has a relatively small default into the position of having to pay off the entire loan debt, because that's going to make it a lot more difficult.
HOA, do you mean homeowners association, like a condominium?
Yes, Your Honor.
Aren't those mostly judicial foreclosures, though, typically?
I believe that a homeowners association has the option of either judicial or non-judicial. But the
point is, if there's, let's say it's this case, and there's one missed payment,
mm-hmm.
and the lender initiated the foreclosure, then under the analysis of the appellant, then they would have to make the entire payment before they could stop the foreclosure.
That's correct, and we don't think that that should be the result. The lender should have the option of exercising its remedies, its rights, as the contract and the law provide, but it should be allowed to do one or the other or both, as the case may be. But it puts borrowers and lenders in an untenable position where a lender's hand is forced. It can't pursue any of its options, any of its rights, unless it pursues all of them.
Let me focus your attention on one of the arguments made by your adversary, and it has to do with the language in paragraph 22 of the deed of trust drafted by your client. If the default is not cured on or before the date specified in the notice, and that's the notice of default, I take it, lender, at its option, may require immediate payment in full of all sums secured by this deed of trust without further demand, and may invoke the power of sale and or any other remedies permitted by applicable law. Now, the argument on the other side appears to be that and in the sentence is conjunctive, What's your response?
My response is would focus on the permissive language in the paragraph, which is may. The lender may do either of those things. So basically, the way that the statute and this paragraph work together is that when the borrower defaults and the lender wants to exercise one of its remedies, it has to provide a notice. And the notice that it provides is dependent upon the remedy that it wishes to exercise. So, for example, a lender could only accelerate. And if it did, it would need to meet all the requirements in paragraph 22 that relate to acceleration. A lender could non-judicially foreclose. It would have to meet only the requirements of paragraph 22 and, of course, the statutory requirements for a non-judicial foreclosure. If the lender wants to exercise both options, the lender said, I'm fed up with this borrower, I want to be done with it, you got to pay the whole thing or vacate, well, then the lender is going to need to comply with all of the all of paragraph 22 and all of the statute. But our high-level argument holds true in the face of your question, Your Honor, which is the lender just has to do what's required notice-wise based on the remedy that it's choosing to exercise.
Let me ask you another question. You are asking for attorney's fees on appeal, and I take it you don't have any quarrel with the factual concession that LLC did not sign the loan documents, correct?
Correct.
And the LLC apparently did not assume and agree to pay the loan, correct?
Correct.
So what's the basis for your request for attorney's fees?
Oh, well, Your Honor, the LLC first raised in its summary judgment papers this issue of attorney's fees.
I don't care when they raised it. You're asking for fees on appeal. What's the basis for your request for fees on appeal?
Our basis is the contract, and the reason we believe that the contract is enforceable against the LLC is the LLC's admission in both its summary judgment papers and its appellate papers that it's subject to the attorney's fees provision of
the
contract.
Well, you can talk about admissions. I'm talking about a basis for award of attorney's fees. And here in Washington, there are limited bases. Contract, statute, recognized ground of equity. You're trying to enforce an attorney's fees provision in a document they did not sign. What's the case in which you rely to allow that?
Your Honor, we rest simply, there's nothing, we don't have anything else, Your Honor. We rest simply on the language of the contract and my adversary's admission.
Okay.
The last point I'd like to make before I sit down is a point also raised by the court, and that is that not only do the notices not provide for the automatic acceleration of the debt, but every notice in the record that relates to the amount due throughout the entire life of this loan has always indicated an amount due that is less than the full principal balance plus accrued interest. There's always been a call for a partial payment, and that was true in 2008, and that was true in 2015, and that was true with the mortgage statement that we put into the record in our summary judgment papers. Of course, on summary judgment, once the absence of a genuine issue of material fact is established by the moving party, it's on the non-moving party to come forward with some evidence to the contrary, and there simply is not any evidence in the record, aside from this automatic argument. There's no evidence in the record that the lender ever called for the borrower to make a full payment of the total amount due on the loan. You only have a request for partial payment. So when you go back to the definition of acceleration, which we quoted at length from Black's Law Dictionary and also Washington case law and the Glassmaker case, which uses the clear and unequivocal language, we don't have anything like that in the record. What we have is a lender consistently requesting that their borrower pay the amounts owed, not the total amount of the loan. And, of course, those amounts owed increase over time as the borrower continues to fail to make payments and interest continues to accrue. But we never have. We never have an explicit call from the lender that the total loan be paid off. And so the appellant is left in the position of arguing a sort of automatic foreclosure equals acceleration position, which, as we've discussed, we would submit as without support. I see that I still have about 45 seconds, but unless the court has any other questions for me, I'd like to sit down.
So if in a non-judicial foreclosure setting, to cure by virtue of the statute and the deed of trust language, once you're past the 11th day, the debtor has to bring the entire amount payable
I would frame it as the right of the debtor. So once you get within that 11-day window, the debtor has the absolute right to stop the foreclosure sale by paying the total amount due on the loan. The lender could agree within those 11 days, borrower, I will accept only the past due amount. But that provision in the Deed of Trust Act, that is a right of the borrower and can be exercised by the borrower.
But your position is that for purposes of triggering the statute of limitations, that's not the equivalent of an acceleration by the holder of the note.
That's correct, because once again, the statute describes the borrower's right rather than says the loan is accelerated. And, of course, as what happened here is that the 2008 foreclosure never happened, and the lender kept on, you know, going right along saying, here's the amount due. It's getting bigger, but it is not the full amount of the loan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honor, the respondent would have you take from the notice of trustee sale those portions that the lender put in there specifically and not read the rest of the language that the statute requires to be in there, which the borrower is going to have to read. And if anything, if we take what the respondent is saying, it creates tremendous confusion, because the fact of the matter is the notice of trustee sale says that to stop the sale, you have to pay the entire principal and interest secured by the deed of trust, not the amount that they've put in there. So it is very confusing if a borrower was to read it the way the respondent would have the court read it. There's a reason why that statutory language is in there, and the reason is because it is an acceleration. If we don't have a mechanism for acceleration invoked with a sale, then we have what the respondent would argue, we have a 36-year period before any borrower can bring a claim against a bank. That, coupled with the tolling argument that's made in the briefing we didn't get to talk about today, I would really specifically point you to the Division I Bingham case, because if you look at that case, there they said the statute was too late. If you look at the dates, though, they can't be restarting the 6-year statute of limitations from that 11-day period, because if you count, if that were true, if you had to restart the 6 years again, they would have had time in the Bingham case. So
there was one final question. I'm sorry.
Yes.
One final question. So the promissory note is not in the record, at least so far as I can tell, but there's no dispute that it's an installment note as opposed to a demand note.
That is correct. All of the parties are in agreement. It's an installment contract. Therefore, the statute of limitations essentially begins with each installment, unless an acceleration occurs. At that point, there is a tolling, but you have 120 days to do the sale or do something about it. They didn't do a discontinuance of sale until, I think, 6 years later. So you don't get to start the 6-year statute of limitations over again. That's our position.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Both parties?